then we can start to also look at, well, what activities really feel good? What way of selling really feels good to me? Because if we're selling through scarcity, we're also experiencing it ourselves. I don't think it's just that we're enforcing it on other people. So how do I actually know myself? This is what feels pleasurable, what feels right, what feels native, what feels home, and then use this as the baseline for your decisions.
Hello and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. On the show, I interview peak performing world changers in the creative, social impact, and vegan spaces. If you like what you hear on this episode, you're going to want to check out the bonus mini episode that you can access if you DM me at Isolde T on Instagram and you let me know you want it. You'll get access to bonus episodes, new art, my latest writing, and other fun benefits. And now, let's get to the show. Hey there, and welcome to the Innovative Mindset Podcast. I'm your host, Isolde Trachtenberg. Super happy that you've taken the time to be here. I'm also, like, I have to say, just chatting with this person for even a few minutes, I already love her, and you're going to love her too. Let me tell you about Laura Hartley. Laura Hartley is an activist, writer, and founder of an online school for changemakers. You know that's catnip to me. She empowers forward-thinking business leaders on how to live their most meaningful lives while simultaneously creating their deepest impact. She teaches ways to grow a business beyond capitalism, overcome eco-anxiety, ooh, I want to know more about that, burnout, and how to embody collaborative and regenerative forms of leadership. Yes, she's already speaking my language. Her work embodies the space between inner and outer change, and she's committed to helping create the conditions for social healing and collective thriving. Laura lives and works on Gadigal land in Sydney, Australia, but can frequently be found exploring the world. Laura, thank you so much for being here. Welcome.
Thank you, Isolde. I'm so excited to be here.
I have so many questions, but I first of all, I want to, if it's okay with you, just go back a little bit and go, what was the turning point for you? From where you were to where you are now that made you go, you know what? Changing the world, empowering business leaders on how to do that is the thing that I want to do. What led to that? How did you get there?
Oh, that's such a good question. You know, my work is born out of three passions that really coalesce around one question, which is how do we create a more beautiful life and world? So I'm an activist, as you said, primarily in environmental and climate spheres. So I'm really passionate about a regenerative future, what that would look like, the systems that need to change to create that. But I also grew up in a house that was surrounded by personal development, spirituality, coaching. And so I'm equally invested in understanding our inner worlds. Mm. You know, this question of what it means to be human, to be alive at a time like this, to create meaning, the consciousness shift that we need to see. And of course, I'm also passionate about business. You know, I think business is this tremendous source of power to create change, mm-hmm. whether it's small micro solopreneurs or whether it's something a bit larger, you know, whether it should be or not, business is a position of power. And so this means we have the potential to make it revolutionary, to build it, to shape it in a way that is reflective of a more beautiful, a more equitable world. And so out of this, I kind of built my school, finding these three passions of changing the world. What is it that actually needs to happen to help heal the climate crisis? What is it within us that needs to shift? What do we need to explore within us to bring alive? And then how do we change the structures that we live and work in to really create a more harmonious, a more beautiful, a more peaceful world?
I'm quiet for a second because I'm taking all of that in. I don't call it dead air. I call it anticipatory air. Just so you know, you're going to probably hear me do that a lot. Just sort of be here for a second. Wow. Okay. So I love the three sort of strands of your perspective. I think that's phenomenal. And yet you said a whole bunch of stuff that I'm like, okay, let's step back, right? Let's even further. You said that you want to build regenerative systems. And I think that's phenomenal. Yay. I worked at NASA for many years. So you're singing my song. But what does it mean to do that if we're so entrenched in the way sort of we've always done things? How do you make those changes And how do you look at something being regenerative when a lot of the world is using these non-renewable resources and using them up pretty quickly?
That is such a good question. You know, I think, first of all, we need to understand the difference between sustainability and regenerative, or and what we mean by that. You know, sustainability to me really is about just maintaining the status quo without degrading it further.
Mm-hmm,
you know, and for anybody, you know, in the world today, we generally know that, that's not enough. It's not enough to be sustainable in an age of ecological breakdown. And that brings us into this idea of what it means to be regenerative, which is really to infuse life-giving principles into things. Now, I am a climate and environmental activist, but I'm also not a scientist. So I'm not the expert at how are we actually going to change our tangible systems in the world and our ecological system. But we can look to our culture. And what would it mean to have a regenerative culture? What would it mean to infuse life-giving care principles into what we do, to allow space for things to emerge, to consider the relationship between us to perhaps be the most important thing, to put a value on the qualitative more than the quantitative, to really slow down and to look at, okay, well, what is actually coming out of our interactions? What do we want to grow here between us? And that to me is the essence of kind of regenerative culture and regenerative leadership. This really coming back to what does it mean to be human, and what do we, who do we want to be to each other? How do we want to be to each other? And can we create space for something to grow between us?
I most certainly hope so. And I have to say it that way first. And yet, you know, I'm listening to you and I'm going, okay, I love it. I love it. I want to sign up for your school. And yet, again, there's a war going on, I think, between this is business versus, like you said, qualitative benefits, life-giving perspectives. What are some of those, and how do you find leaders' acceptance of those kinds of initiatives?
I mean, I think, first of all, I don't think change comes necessarily from the top first. The people who we traditionally see as leaders, I don't think will actually be the ones who lead a different world.
Okay.
You know, I think change is really emergent. I think power lives at every level. And I think that a different experience of what regenerative actually means and to create a new world will really come from people who are not at necessarily at the forefront right now. But, you know, if we were to look at this idea in business, you know, specifically of the qualitative over the quantitative, I always think of, you know, what does it mean to kind of redefine success? You know, traditionally we see success as profit, as we're going to count X number of things that we're doing. But changing to the qualitative takes a bit of a different approach. Or, and so I was in, have you ever heard of Bhutan, this country?
Sure.
It's nestled between India and China. I visited there about 6 years ago.
Oh, wow.
And they have a wonderful policy of gross national happiness. Now, this is essentially a metric that they use to measure the well-being and happiness of the nation. And it's considered their primary metric of success. So unlike us in the West, we tend to measure GDP, you know, this idea of constant growth. You know, they're really looking, well, actually, does GDP really make us happy? Does it make us feel good? You know, isn't that the point of life? How would we instead measure happiness? And they have a few different metrics that I think we could easily take into our business, into our organizations, into our movements. You know, take health as an example that they measure. How can we measure our stress levels? How rested are we? How rested are our employees? How stressed or calm do our customers feel? You know, stress is a leading driver of so many health issues. We look at time use. Are we just using our business or our work to fill the 9 to 5 hours, or are we doing it to kind of break free of that, to create more time for our employees, our customers? How are we using our time? And what is our relationship to it? Because like so many of us experience, you know, time scarcity or this deficiency. Or if we look at our environment, you know, what feelings does our working environment generate? What is our relationship to the natural world? Are we creating or investing in a circular economy, or are there parts that are falling out of that? There's so many different layers and things that we can look at to kind of understand what success might be, to understand what a regenerative future and what regenerative systems might look at. But it's really looking at the whole, and it's really looking at, well, does this actually generate feelings of life, of aliveness, of spontaneity, of beauty, of hope, you know, or is it kind of built in something that's a little bit stagnant, a little bit dead, a little bit, I've cut down this living thing to provide X, and now I've got X amount of dollars, and that's wonderful, and that's an important thing that we need to measure. But, well, the dollars, not so much the cutting down the living thing. But, you know, there's more to it that we can start to really pay attention to.
I love the notion of that, and you make me want to go visit Bhutan, that's for sure. I feel like I'm in listening to you, I'm going, okay, so that this notion that these changes are going to go not so much as you put it from the top down, but more sort of grassroots, I think is wonderful. And yet, when I look at, like, for me, I work with businesses to do something similar, although for me, conservation and that arena comes through creative thinking rather than regenerative thinking. But either way, a lot of times people are really set in their ways. And so I end up going into schools a lot and working with tomorrow's decision makers, because they're the ones who will be making decisions in 10, 15 years. And so what I wonder is, when you're in this, when you're working with a company or an organization and you're going, okay, let's take this more grassroots approach. Here in the USA, we have songs saying, you know, we're working for the weekend, right? People are working jobs often that they don't like because they're trying to afford the life that they want to have, or the life, or keep affording the life that they have. So what kind of mindset shift do you recommend? And do you have any ideas on how people might start to start looking at it differently, to start looking at it instead of I'm working for the weekend, maybe I don't have as many resources or as much money, but I'm getting to enjoy my life more all 7 days of the week.
Yes. I mean, God, we all experience this feeling of time scarcity, don't we? This idea that, you know, we come in on Monday, we're like, how's your weekend? Like, oh, it was good, but it wasn't long enough. You know, this sense that there's just never enough hours in the day. What's another one? When we're in meetings and, you know, we have a lot to fit in today, we're just going to squeeze it all in. Like, this feeling of being deficient in time is so prevalent to all of our cultures, I think. And I think that really helps influence, you know, our sense of, or how much power we think we have. You know, if we're in a job that we don't like and we're just living for the weekend, you know, I think that does come down to this shift of, okay, well, how do I want my relationship to time to be? How do I want to feel about my work? How do I want to feel day to day? And while we have to live in the system that we live in a capitalist system, and, you know, very often, if you don't work, you will end up homeless, you will starve. There are all of these horrifying threats that abound. Mm-hmm. But we can find a way to then perhaps look at our values, to think creatively, to think laterally. Well, how could I start to make a shift? What could I do today to think about what type of business I might want to start? What type of side hustle I might want to start that might give me more freedom, that might give me a little bit more space or peace within me? And then from there, just creating that idea, that seed of a little bit of space to go, okay, you know what? Maybe I have more time. Maybe it's not so much time that's the issue. It's my relationship to it. Maybe I can trust that there is enough. Maybe I can start to notice, what would it feel like to be satisfied, to feel good, to feel satiated? And then use those little pockets of feeling, those little seedlings that we can start to find to spark something new. You know, I think sometimes we want this big change to come out of nowhere, whether that's in the world or in our lives. You know, in our personal lives, if we're in a job that we don't like, we want it to just change overnight and to have a whole new career and to be at the top and everything's perfect. Or if it's the world, we want war to end tomorrow. We want climate change to end tomorrow. We want racial injustice to just end tomorrow. And, you know, rightly, in an ideal world, the world as it should be, they should. But in the world as it is, you know, change does take a bit of time. There is this seeding process that takes place. And so how are we working with that seeding process? Are we doing it intentionally? Are we saying, yeah, no, this feels good, this feels right, this is kind of what I want? Or are we ignoring it or demanding it that be faster than it is? And this is, again, that essence of life, I think, understanding that seeds take time to grow. They need the darkness before they bloom.
It's funny how many metaphors and similes you and I that use that are similar, because I also talk about a seed. Sometimes it's a butterfly coming out of a cocoon. This notion that yeah, you need to be in the darkness, but also it can be kind of a violent thing for a seed to break out of its shell. It can be a huge kaboom for the seed. And so it takes some kind of pressure to change. And it reminds me of that Anais Nin quote, you know, and then the day came when the pain it took to stay wrapped tight in a bud became greater than the pain it took to blossom. And I love that quote, because what are we talking about here? We're talking about getting to the point where you realize that you need to make a change. And that takes some self-awareness. So when you're doing that, when you're talking about making some of those changes, they're internal changes first. Can you talk a little bit about what that change looks like, especially when it comes to, like you said, this capitalist society that we live in?
You know, it's funny. I really believe that all change, whether it's inner or outer, it kind of, I don't know if one actually comes first. I think they really influence the other. Mm-hmm. But I do talk about something called internalized capitalism. And internalized capitalism is the equation of our worth with our productivity. You know, essentially, when we feel guilty for taking time off, when we feel like we always need to be working, that we need to be giving more, doing more, being more, you know, this constant extraction of our energy in order to produce is a symptom of internalized capitalism. And I think that is probably one of the awareness shifts that we actually need to start to see in the world, that we tend to view our personal development and self-help and these wonderful industries that have so much good work sometimes tend to view personal change as this sole responsibility of the individual, that it's all that you are responsible for your life, but therefore also, you know, you're kind of to blame for your life. And that is true to an extent. We have much more power than we think we do. We have much more ability to influence and to shift our circumstances more than I think many of us think. But we are also the product of the system that we live in. And what it means to be human also means, well, what does it mean to be human living in a 21st century capitalist society? This is not the only way to be human. This is just the predominant way that we've created. And so to create this sense of awareness first, I think that actually, you know, not everything is just me. I am an individual. You know, I have my own thoughts, my own feelings, but they have been shaped by the culture that I live in. And so if I want to understand myself better, how can I perhaps also first start to look at understanding my culture, understanding my family dynamics, understanding my community? What patterns do I see there? And how has that influenced me? You know, this inner and outer is not separate. They're kind of deeply intertwined. So when we lack self-awareness, I think seeing if we can gain it elsewhere really helps us then look within ourselves, if that makes sense.
Oh, absolutely it does. It makes all sorts of sense. And your point is well taken, that we might have this inner to the outside change, or we might have this outer to the inside change. It feels to me, though, that when we want to make a conscious change, we are required to build a habit, and the habit does need to sort of have that awareness that something needs to change, and you need to want to do it, and all of that, because it doesn't happen by rote, right? Like you said, it's not just an automatic response, and it's not just an automatic fix. So it's going to take some time. And if, as you say, you know, we have this bizarre relationship with time anyway, what does someone who wants to make that change need to do in order to embark on this regenerative way of living and working?
I think it's exactly what you're saying. It does come down to intentionality, and it comes down to habits and to making that conscious choice. You know, as aware as I am of time scarcity, and as much as I do to kind of heal that within myself, I very much default to this a lot, this feeling of like you know, panic that there's just not enough time. I'm not going to get everything done. There's so much that needs to happen. Things aren't happening fast enough. You know, I need to move faster and do more and give more. And every time I notice that, it's just that pausing and that there's this moment where you can pause and you can come back and go, okay, is this what I want? Or is this just a habit? You know, I feel like I'm going to butcher this quote, but I think it was Viktor Frankl who said, you know, between stimulus and response, there is a space, and in that space lies our power to choose.
Mm.
And that's the space that we're looking for. And it comes through practice. It comes through intentionally finding some time to be still, to be in nature. That might be meditation. It might be surfing. It might be knitting. But, you know, something that brings us stillness so that we can then pick up on that little space where we have that choice and go, oh, no, okay, that's just my habit. That's just the pattern that I have. And I'm going to change it again. And it does require doing it multiple times. You know, change doesn't happen overnight. It's not a one-time thing. It's really a practice. And it's really something that we get to work on every day.
Yeah, I absolutely. It is. My husband says to me quite often that if I predecease him, he's going to put on my epitaph, you know, there's just so much to do. That comes out of my mouth a lot, because I feel like that, like for everything I achieve, there are kajillions of other things that I want to do, that I feel like I need to do, et cetera, et cetera. And I know there are a lot of people out there who measure their success by what they've achieved, by what they've accomplished, by money that they've earned, all of that. It sounds to me like what you're talking about, though, is a different way of measuring your success. Right? And if so, what is it? What is the way that you would measure success? And is it, am I totally off base, or is that something that you address in the with the people that you work with in your school?
No, absolutely. That's definitely something that we address. You know, I think first of all, looking at this idea of success in our society, success is about growth. Success is about, you know, what you've achieved. It's about hitting the milestone. It's about production. But even when you reach that place, even when you reach that achievement, that production, it's never enough.
Mm-hmm.
There's always something more. You know, there's always this next rung on the ladder. And there's this idea that when you reach this place, when you've got the right job and you've got the right amount of money and you've met the right partner and you're married and you're settled down and whatever it might be, that you will be happy. And what we tend to find in our culture is that place doesn't exist. You know, we have an epidemic of burnout, of depression, of stress. We are not a happy society. We are not a well-functioning society. Mm. And I think this is because we kind of get caught on this treadmill of always looking for the next place. Now, I see the roots of this to be in our systems, to be in capitalism. Capitalism doesn't know what satisfaction is. It doesn't know what it is to be satiated. It doesn't know what it is to feel like there is enough. So really coming back to this idea of, well, actually, within my own body, within my own heart, within my own mind, do I know what it feels like to feel satisfied? Do I know what it feels like to feel like there's enough, to feel pleasurable, to feel fulfilled? Can I actually know what those feelings are like and experience them in my body? And a lot of the time we can't. I don't think I could for a long time. You know, I've certainly struggled with depression and burnout myself in the past. They've been influences of my work. And you know, there's many different reasons for them. But to live in a culture that doesn't actually know those feelings, or systems that don't know those feelings, means that we really need to start to practice them ourselves as individuals. And that's what it means to kind of uproot capitalism. It's what it means to create a difference in the world. You know, using your life as activism, or using your business as activism, isn't about, you know, tokenistic diversity or, you know, symbolic Earth Day or whatever it might be. It's about uprooting ourselves from the systems that we live in. So this idea of measuring success differently comes first. Do I actually know what success feels like? Do I know what satisfaction feels like? And then if we want something a little bit, you know, more tangible, this may not be tangible, beyond the kind of gross national happiness metrics that I mentioned before, you know, we need to look to this qualitative or relational over the transactional quantitative. So like, we tend to measure X numbers of dollars, but even in our impact of people of the earth, we try to bring it down to quantitative numbers. You know, we have X percent diversity. We offer X benefits to our staff. We planted X number of trees. But we can also just ask, how does this feel? How do I feel like I belong to this? How much meaning does this bring me? How much meaning does this bring my community? And these are really the things that matter, you know, meaning, connection, belonging, much more than growth, productivity, or output.
Okay. Wow. All right. I love that you said what you said, because I agree as an individual, as a person listening to you, Laura, I'm going, yes, absolutely. The interaction, connection, all of those things are the things that matter. Awareness of self, but also awareness of the community, awareness of the ecosystem. Absolutely, it matters. And yet, the thing that I'm thinking about right now is, within that framework, this is a strange question, but maybe it's not. What if the thing that makes you feel like you have enough, you do enough, and you are enough isn't something you can get paid for?
I would challenge whether it is. I mean, whether that's actually true, for starters. Okay. I mean, people get paid to do a whole variety of things. Mm-hmm. So we're like, really, is it that you can't get paid, or is it that perhaps we need to think a little bit more creatively about how to get paid?
Okay.
And I probably don't have an example of that. I think actually, maybe I do. It was something only recently where I read about a woman who moved out to somewhere in Alaska and started a blog about fish and ended up like doubling, tripling, or I think it was quadrupling her income or something. So, you know, there is any number of ways that we can start to think creatively about, oh, how could I actually connect this idea to more people? How could it help them? How could I create a service around it? How could I create some content around it and then create an area to get paid? But also, this idea that we need to be paid for everything that we love, for all our hobbies, is again a very capitalist idea that we need to monetize everything that we do. So maybe it is just a hobby that you do on the side, that you keep your love for it for out of work hours, and your work isn't something you hate. It doesn't mean it's, you know, something that is like makes you totally miserable, but it's something that pays the bills and it lets you live well and you enjoy it enough and you have a good community from it and you have a good connection from it. But like your real love is something that perhaps you do outside of work. This idea that everything needs to just fit within the current system isn't entirely accurate, I think.
I guess the thing that I'm thinking about is, a lot of the messaging, there are so many, you know, business gurus and all of that that are out there, not naming any names, but they're all basically saying, you know, you can get paid for doing what you love and da, 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 da. And that's not necessarily true, with your point being well taken. And yet that's the messaging, right? So you've started this school. Well, go ahead.
I think it is true. Like, you know, it is true in one sense. I do work that I love, and I was very conscious that I wanted my work to be something that I loved. You know, I worked a lot of jobs that I didn't like for a long time, and I was always looking to find how I could make my work something that I love. Now, that took a lot of trial and error. It took trying things and actually discovering I didn't love them as much as I thought I did. It took trying things and loving them, but like failing horribly at them. And then, you know, it's kind of emerged into what it is now. And I love my work. And I know I love it because I hop off my calls and I hop off my courses with more energy than when I start. And that to me is like my default, my baseline of, okay, that's what I want in my business. When I'm doing something I love, it gives me energy. I don't get home at the end of the day going, oh God, I'm so tired. I'm so drained. I have nothing left. But not everyone needs to do a job that they absolutely love. And that's not important to everyone. If it is important to you, I believe it is possible. I think there are ways, very creative ways, to turn a lot of people's ideas and loves and passions into business. You know, I actually have, there are so many friends of mine who are like, oh yeah, I love this thing, but like I could never earn enough doing that. And I always want to challenge that. Is that actually true? Or is that just true in the world that you've seen? What about in the world you haven't seen? Can you think a bit more creatively to create that, if that is what you want? But sometimes, actually, people would rather leave their hobbies and their passions as their hobbies and their passions, things that they do outside of work, you know, and their work is to help them, you know, live day to day, to provide connection, to provide what, to provide money and resources and whatever else it may be. It isn't a necessity for everyone. And that's why I want to outline it. It's not that every single person needs to be self-employed, not that every single person needs to have, you know, mind-blowing work that they love. I think sometimes there's actually power in doing work that you don't love, but that is still fulfilling in a different way. So finding this kind of balance between the two. Okay, do I really know what I love? Can I do what I love? Can I think creatively to create it? And, you know, all the things that that comes with, or reassess, do I want to keep this as a hobby and I just feel like I need to monetize it? And what would actually a more fulfilling job look like?
I feel like every time you finish talking, you should just go, mic drop. That's great. Okay. So if someone doesn't have to have this absolutely fulfilling work life, but they want to, I don't even know how to say it, they want to either use their business or use the work that they're doing to make a difference that is greater than in their own little sphere, how would we do that? What do we need to do? Because as you said, we live in a capitalist society, and that tends to be an achieve thing, as opposed to connect and grow in a different way thing. What would someone need to do to look beyond capitalism, maybe, and see their business or the work that they're doing, if they don't own a business, in a way that would be beyond capitalism, if we're looking to sort of subvert the current way most of this society runs?
So two things. I think we need to understand that, one, business and capitalism are not the same thing. You know, so often we kind of equate the two in our minds. Business is like this exchange of goods or services. You know, it is a way to be compensated for our labor. It is a way to share our gifts and our talents and our interests. And capitalism is a way that, or the predominant way that we have in the Western countries anyway, to organize our business, organize commerce, organize wealth. And it's based on three fundamental principles. The first of these is the pursuit of infinite growth on a finite planet. Yeah, and that is the leading driver of the climate crisis and the struggles that we face, and why I'm so passionate about this. The second, though, is the artificial production of scarcity. You know, the whole reason we pursue infinite growth is because scarcity is embedded into the system. Every time we grow, there's scarcity somewhere else to generate more growth. And then the third is this devaluation of complex, living, robust systems into lifeless resources. Now, the whole point of business as activism is not about token displays of solidarity. It's not about distant goals of being net zero by 2050. And it's also not about playing it small and being a nonprofit or not charging what you're worth. It is about uprooting and challenging the toxic systems that we face. So, namely, in this case, capitalism. Now, to really challenge capitalism as business owners to move beyond it, we need to understand what the system is. So understanding those three points, infinite growth, artificial scarcity, and devaluing living systems. And then look at the ways that we have internalized it, the subtle ways that it shows up in our decision-making, our values, our habits, our marketing, our strategy, and challenging it piece by piece. So, you know, in business, the most common one, or the easiest example here, is really scarcity, that we see scarcity as a condition of business. We use it in marketing all the time. And to me, that's really out of alignment with a post-capitalist world. I don't think we need to sell from scarcity. I think we can sell from trust. I think we can sell from relationships. We can sell from a place of honesty. And there is a place for like real scarcity. If you're actually running a workshop and you have 50 seats in the room and only there's three left, that's real, genuine scarcity. Share it. But if you have like an online webinar or an evergreen seminar and you see them all the time and there's like two seats left, you know, closing in 1 hour and it's going to run again actually in 3 hours, that's artificial scarcity, you know, and that is something that we can step back from. You know, another piece is perhaps in payment. You know, that so often payment plans actually end up charging a person more than if they were able to pay up front. So we're punishing people for not being financially able. And that, again, is kind of not really something that I would imagine in a post-capitalist future. Now, the only other thing that I would say about this is that the idea of a world beyond capitalism or post-capitalism is still something that we're creating. You know, it's not formed yet. And that's kind of the beauty of it. We get to co-create it together. And there is this quote I love. I don't know who said it again. It says, you know, it's literally easier to imagine the apocalypse, the literal end of the world, than it is to imagine a world beyond capitalism. But that world exists. And the way that we start to create it and the way we start to run a business beyond it is simply to start understanding the system and then start looking at piece by piece my participation in it. And then that is the kind of seeding that we have to create the new world, to create business beyond capitalism.
I have to say, I love the notion. I think it's a great notion. And when I think about it, I'm going, okay, back in the dawn of time when there were, you know, before even agronomy became a thing, right? There were lots of nomadic tribes that were wandering around. And somebody had to gather the firewood. And it was this person's job in the little tribe or the little family unit to go gather the firewood. But they didn't want to gather the firewood. And they said, hey, if you gather the firewood for me, I will give you these 15 grapes or whatever, because you're not just going to do it for me. I have to trade something for it, for you to do that. And that's sort of the beginning of commerce, right? I don't want to have to do my own gathering of strawberries. I'll pay someone and then I'll go to a store and I'll buy the strawberries that somebody else already gathered. So at some point, and I don't know the exact sort of timeline of this, but at some point we developed legal tender and all of this other stuff, and people who don't want to do the thing that would take them a lot of time that somebody else might have better skill set for or whatever, they'll pay for it, right? And so if we keep doing that and we keep extrapolating it, we have today's capitalist system. Beyond that, what I'm hearing you say is that we can go past it and start looking at business that is focused on doing and also being more regenerative. But won't there be people who always go, ah, but I'll pay you for X and or well, I'll buy X?
Paying people for X isn't essentially capitalist. You know, that is business. That's commerce. That's trade. There's nothing wrong with saying, actually, you know what? I really do not like doing this. I'm going to pay you to do this. Somebody else might actually enjoy doing this, or somebody else might not mind doing it if they're getting paid. You know, what is the issue here is when we're not paying people fairly, when it's not equitable. You know, business itself is not capitalism. You know, there's, if I'm paying somebody to manage my website, if I'm paying somebody to build a product that I'm not able to build, as long as they are paid fairly, and as long as I am looking at the system from kind of start to finish, particularly product development, and seeing what might be falling off the wagon and, you know, what am I contributing to? That is not a problem. You know, there's nothing inherently wrong with that. The issue is when we start to see it as, well, actually, you know what? I'm going to pay you X amount of dollars to pick this fruit, but I am going to charge and sell this for 100 times more and make sure that I here in the middle am getting the vast majority and I'm not paying you fairly. That's where the problem lies. So there's always going to be people who, you know, one, I don't believe in this idea of bad people and good people and, you know, this inherentness, but there are conditions that lead to scarcity, that lead to greed, that lead to power over and domination and things like that. Will that always exist? Probably. But can we create a robust system, both ethical system, a moral system, a legal system, an economic system that perhaps places value in other things, that perhaps limits that, and actually not just limits that, but really creates the conditions for thriving, the conditions for most people to feel good in what they're doing. And I think that is possible.
I don't disagree at all. I would like to think that it's possible. And I understand there's a guy who, I think he's in Washington State or Oregon. He's the CEO of a company, and he basically brought his own salary down and brought everybody else's salary up so that nobody makes less than $70,000 a year. That's it. And everyone was like, you're nuts. You're crazy. You're never going to make a success of your business. And of course, his business has grown exponentially because the people there stay there and they're happy, et cetera, et cetera. And yet we also have, you know, in in that part of the world, we have Amazon. And Amazon, you look at the CEO making kajillions of percent more than the average worker. And that's just, that's how it is. So I guess, how would you, if somebody came to you and said, okay, I work in this company and we have such a disparity between what management and up makes versus the workers making, what would your advice be? How would you get that change to start happening in a company like that?
Mm. You know, I mean, I think Amazon is like such a big example here. Like that, like for sure. We've gone to like the monolith of companies. So I think, first of all, from an individual perspective, I'd probably ask that person whether they actually want to be, continue being part of that system. And that's, they may want to stay there and be part of trying to change it, or it might actually be better for them as an individual to leave and to find a different place where they have more power to make change. I also think that when we act collectively, we have far more power. So it might be that that person actually is like, you know what, this is not for me anymore. I don't want to be a part of this system. I don't even want to put my energy into fixing this system because it is so far beyond me. But I'm actually going to get as many people as I can, perhaps, to follow suit. Now, this is a wonderful idea. But obviously, we also live in the world as it is, and we have bills to pay and jobs to pay and, you know, families to look after and everything else. But if you can't leave, if you're going to stay within it, and if you're going to say, well, okay, I'm going to see what I can do, I think it's this understanding the idea that change is emergent. It's not something that is just a decision-making power from up above. Change, I really believe, can start at every level. And some companies, and I would dare say Amazon is one of them, having said that I haven't worked there, will be very, very, very slow to follow. They will resist and they will fight and they will go into this new world dragging and kicking and screaming. And so I wouldn't expect to see a fast moving radical change in a company of that size or of that value system. But I still think perhaps then if you're going to choose to work there and you're going to continue to be there, look at, how can I influence my managers? How can I work with my colleagues to talk about how we want to work together? How can I organize with my colleagues and say, you know what? Okay, how can we do this differently? How can we challenge this power imbalance in this company? How can we start to claim more power? And you've seen that recently with unions in Amazon. It's wonderful to see. So this challenging of power, it's coming back to, is this actually a system that I want to be part of changing? And if we have no choice, well then, how can I accept my participation in it? How can I challenge my participation in it? And then how can I work with those people around me to really start to shift the dynamics so that it's not always top down and so that collectively we can bargain together?
Mm. It takes a lot of courage, I think, to do that, to go, okay, you know what? I can have that kind of power. I can make a change. I can influence or have an impact in that way. Yet it seems to me, when I'm thinking about it, I'm like, yeah, in smaller companies, yes. But in these leviathans, you know, the Amazon and the FedEx and whoever else, those are harder to change, as you said. And there's not a lot of motivation for upper management to make those kinds of changes. And in fact, if one person leaves, there are four people more who are going, yeah, I'll take that job. So the job itself doesn't have to change that much from the eyes of the company. But how do we collectively, since collective thinking seems to be something that is core to what you're saying, how can we do that? How can we envision and act towards a world beyond capitalism or a modified capitalism? Where do we need to start? And does it need to be, again, grassroots, individual, or can small companies be the drivers of some of that change?
I mean, first of all, I want to say I do think it needs to be beyond capitalism and not a modified capitalism. Modified capitalism is just conscious capitalism. And capitalism has this tremendous ability to consume movements and messages that aim to disrupt it. You know, there's a lot of feminist movements, a lot of spiritual movements that are now disguised capitalism. Wellness is a great example. A lot of wellness is now disguised capitalism. And conscious capitalism is ultimately still a tool that damages the earth and hurts people. You know, it's not, and it's still connected to the status quo. It adds this idea of living systems and caring for the environment, it broadens the bottom line, but it doesn't deal with the fundamental issues of infinite growth on a finite planet, and it doesn't deal with artificial scarcity. So we can't just modify the tool. I really think we need to abandon the tool and actually create something new. The idea that capitalism is the greatest invention of all time, or this is peak humanity, is just really not thinking creatively enough to me. But I do think actually, I'm not saying that large companies like Amazon can't be part of changing the world. I think they can, but I also think they're so invested in the status quo. They're so part of the problem and the world as it is that they can't yet imagine the world as it could be. And so I think that this change that we're looking for will actually come from smaller companies. It will come from individuals. It will come from individuals working collectively. And then whether we like it or not, some of those companies that are doing incredibly well now, I think into the future, will start to struggle a little bit more as resources become more scarce, as environmental collapse becomes more common. You know, these are realities that we're facing. If you look at the science and the predictions over the next 10, 20, 30, 50 years, we're going to be in a very different world to what we are now. Now, these companies, very likely, if they're continuing with the same mindset, the same values, the same habits, will simply try to extract more, exploit more and more people will suffer. You know, people work those jobs not because they pay well, not because they're cared for as employees. They work them because the system we live in says that they have to or they will starve. But hopefully, there's enough of us who can start to challenge the system, who can start to talk to people about, you know, just asking the question, what would a world beyond capitalism look like? Because it doesn't exist yet. We get to create it. So starting to imagine it, starting to vision it. No matter what job we're in, no matter what company we work for, we have more power than we think we do. And then break it down again. Okay, well, a world beyond capitalism. I think it would have more abundance. I think it would have more care. I think it would focus a little bit less on growth and more on seasons and cycles, things that are more aligned with the natural world. Okay, how can I start to live like that in my own life? How can I start to make my choices based not around scarcity, but around abundance? How can I start to change my own internal measures of what makes me worthy, of what makes me valuable, of what makes me successful, away from, you know, this idea that I need to be constantly hustling, achieving, growing, the next thing, and onto what feels good, what feels pleasurable, what feels satisfying. And this, where it starts with us, is where that seed begins, because our systems are not just out there. They really live and exist within us, through us, as us. The whole reason that, you know, they've been propped up for centuries is because they've become so embedded into our mindset, into our bodies, into our nervous systems. So I think that internal shift is where it occurs. And then from there, there will be sparks, there'll be pockets, and there already are, of a world beyond capitalism and of a world that is more equitable, more just, that has more beauty. So this coming back to me here right now, how do I see the world? How do I see myself? How can I start to challenge my participation? You know, it's kind of like a corny way to say, you know, be the change you want to see. But, you know, a really kind of nuanced way as well, this internalization of the new world first.
I guess first you have to think it's possible and then things will come after that. If that's the case. And by the way, I want to step back for a second and say I agree with you that artificial scarcity is one of the things that makes me grit my teeth like crazy. But at the same time, again, this is what people know to do. And in my mind, a lot of the online gurus who teach you how to market or teach you how to have your sales funnels and that's what they say you should do. You know, if you want people to buy your thing, you have to tell them that there's only two of them left in all the world. And yet if I'm starting a business today, right, what do I need to keep in mind as I start a business now in order to work beyond capitalism or in this regenerative mindset or paradigm?
I think where they start and what they keep in mind to begin is just this idea of what does it mean to be satisfied, and do I know the sensation of feeling like there is enough? Because until we can start to explore that feeling within us, we're always going to be looking, pursuing, seeking something more. And it's not to say that feeling's going to last forever. Like, you know, I'm just permanently living this state of like satisfaction and I feel great now. But when we can start to know this is what it feels like, then we can start to also look at, well, what activities really feel good? What way of selling really feels good to me? Because if we're selling through scarcity, we're also experiencing it ourselves. I don't think it's just that we're enforcing it on other people. So how do I actually know myself? This is what feels pleasurable, what feels right, what feels native, what feels home. And then use this as the baseline for your decisions. I think that is the beginning entry point to this work. And then you're right, there's so much bro marketing out there. There is so many gurus out there who, and many of them with great advice and with great wisdom, but they do sell this idea that, you know, scarcity, you have to sell from scarcity, or, you know, you have to like work harder than everyone else. You know, you got to get up for 5 a.m. You got to hustle. You got to work 22 hours a day. You got to give everything on your dream. And I don't think that's entirely true. I think it's really stepping back to what feels good right now.
I can't help thinking, Laura, that what you're talking about is revolutionary. It feels revolutionary to me. And I love it. Don't get me wrong. I love the notion. And we're living in a time where I can, you know, I'm in New York City. You are in Sydney, Australia. We're in a different, you know, it's what, 8:30, 9 o'clock in the morning for you. It's 6 p.m. here for me. It's so different. And yet here we are from the other side of the world. We're talking and we're having this incredible discussion. And none of that is possible without people who want to push the limits, who want to push the boundaries. And I guess my question to you is, because I speak a lot on creative thinking and innovation, does it all come back to what feels good? Or is there another motivating factor there that will push people to envision and imagine something different than what has ever come before, as far as technology, as far as advances, things like that?
I think it was Michael Beckwith who once said, the pain pushes until the vision pulls. And, you know, not everyone is pulled by vision or by what feels good. You know, to me, what feels good, and I want to be careful that what feels good, you know, I really mean what feels satisfying, what feels satiating, will be different to different people. And that's really a baseline for a new measure of success and for a new guidance for decisions. But in many cases, to get to where we want to go, actually, I think a large number of us for a while, and hopefully not many people listening to this call, or at least certainly not now, will be pushed by pain, you know, that they won't be feeling good. They won't be feeling pleasurable, that we're like, this is actually really dissatisfying, that I'm stressed all of the time, that I feel like there's never enough, that I don't earn enough, that, you know, I'm not worthy enough, I'm not valuable enough. This feeling of always seeking something more, or just something is missing, you know, it's often that feeling that then gets us questioning, well, actually, what is missing? What is meaningful? What would a different world look like? And the reality is, I mean, a lot of my work came out of an incredible grief and an incredible fear about climate change in the future. You know, that is pain. It's love and it's pain together, and they've both motivated me in a way. So it's not always about feeling good. I don't believe you can feel good or feel happy every single second of your life. But it is establishing what a new baseline or a new measure of success is and what is most important to us. And that my happiness, my genuine real happiness, my genuine satisfaction doesn't come from the exploitation of others. It doesn't come from others suffering. It doesn't come from the earth suffering. It comes from working in alignment with the natural world. It comes from experiencing a feeling of abundance. It comes from experiencing a sense of wholeness, a sense of what it feels like to be enough, and of having my connection to a vision larger than me. And that is something that I've cultivated. It's something we all cultivated. But yeah, the pain pushes until the vision pulls, I think.
As a vegan, I'm standing here and cheering silently for you. Absolutely. All of that, all of what you just said rings very true to me, and it's certainly how I try to live my life. And again, I come back to what I'm hearing from you is that businesses can be activists. How? How can business be activism?
So first, I subscribe to Joanna Macy's definition of an activist, which is anybody who is active for a purpose bigger than personal gain. You know, when I say that I'm a climate activist, I've been involved in direct action movements. I've been involved in petitions, in looking at well-being economies. There are many different ways to be an activist. You know, direct action climate movements have a very, very, very important place. But what I also call activism is building the new world. You know, it's not just about resisting the systems that exist. At the same time that we starve the system, that we resist the system, we also need to seed alternatives. We need to seed a new world. And this is when business becomes activism. You know, it's not about token displays of solidarity. It's not about, you know, putting a post up for Black Lives Matter or Me Too or Earth Day. It's not about the distant goals of sustainability. It is really about how are we participating in toxic systems like patriarchy, like capitalism, white supremacy, understanding how these systems, which still exist in the world today, have historically been used by business, like that business has used them to, or capitalism has used it to further themselves. And then look at, well, how do I participate in them? Break it down. It is not about something far off in the future. It's not about just acknowledging what's happening today. It's finding all of the subtle ways that I participate in the habits of capitalism, all the subtle ways that I have internalized it, all the subtle ways that perhaps my business is still reflective of white supremacy. You know, how is my marketing still unconsciously, perhaps sometimes people who just look like me? You know, how could I be more inclusive in my hiring decisions so that people who historically would actually have less opportunity might have a little bit more? How, instead of like just focusing on having X number of diversity, can I really first set the conditions for inclusivity in my business, in my community, in my organization? What would real inclusivity feel like for most people? And so often we look at, or we think about what it looks like, we try to look for it, to see it. But I think these things also come from a feeling. You know, we know when we feel accepted in a place, when we feel like we belong. It's hard to say exactly what it looks like sometimes, although we can sometimes give examples, but everyone's a bit different. But we all know what it feels like. So coming back to this idea of, yeah, okay, I run a business. I have a position of power. We all have more power than we think we do. What would it be like for me to use my business to create something new? What would that look like? And then it is just the imagining of it. You know, this is the beauty of it. We haven't created the world. We use our business as activism to really birth something new. It's not that it's all done. It's not that everybody's done it. You get to be part of creating it.
I'm sitting. I wish I had pom-poms because I'd be cheering you. That's great. I love it. I love it.
Thank you.
Absolutely. No, that was great. I appreciate you taking the time to talk with me, Laura. That was the perfect place to end this episode. I don't want to rock the boat any more than that. I feel like that was a beautiful encapsulating way of saying that these changes not only are possible, but if we're going to, quite frankly, save ourselves, they're going to be necessary. So I am right there with you, and I'm super, super excited about the school that you're running. And I would love it if you don't mind. If somebody goes, I want to work with Laura Hartley, I want to know more about her, can you do me a favor? And people learn differently, so I'm going to have it in the show notes written down, but I'd love it if you would say how people can find you on social, your website, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera.
Yeah, absolutely. My website is laurahartley.com. I'm on Instagram at laura.h.hartley. I'm also on LinkedIn. You're welcome to look me up. And there is a new program starting in the next few months. It is called Business for the Revolution, which is really a 3-month container for people to start to break this work down and imagine a business beyond capitalism. So thank you so much for having me on the show. I have loved this conversation.
Me too. I do want to say this episode probably won't air until like June or July or so. So can you do me a favor? Do you have an approximate date for when this for Business for the Revolution is going to start so that we can say that?
It's actually starting in about August. Sorry.
Okay. No, that's perfect. That works out very well because your episode will run right around August. So that's great. So if you're interested in joining this really, really sounds like an amazing program, Business for the Revolution with Laura Hartley, it's coming up very soon. So go look up laurahartley.com and find out more about Business for the Revolution. Laura, once again, I'm super grateful that you took the time to be here. And I have just one last question that I ask every single person who comes on the show, and it's a silly question, but I find that it yields some pretty profound answers. And the question is this: if you had an airplane, environmentally friendly, of course, that could skywrite anything for the whole world to see, what would you say?
Ooh, I think there's two things I'd say, and I know that's cheating.
Ah, there's no cheating. Go for it.
Another world is possible, but you have to believe in her first. You cannot create this other world without believing in her. And two, to know your power. Every single one of us has so much more power than we think we do. Like, we have power to influence our families, our communities, our cultures, our governments, our businesses, our workplaces. Know your power and own it. See what you can do with it. I think knowing your power is revolutionary, and it is where we start to seed a more beautiful world.
I love it. And I love that you refer to the world as her. That makes me very happy. It reminds me of the Gaia principle. So I'm super glad that you said that. I am super excited to have you come back in just a minute. So if you like this episode, you need to go listen to the wee bonus episode that Laura and I are going to record in just a second. I will let you know in the show notes how to get to it. Until next time, this is Isolde Trachtenberg. So grateful to Laura Hartley for taking the time. And I remind you, as always, if you're listening to this, to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind. Thank you so much for joining me today. I really appreciate you being here. Please subscribe to the podcast if you're new, and it would mean the world to me if you told a friend about it. Today's episode was produced by Isolde Trachtenberg and is copyright 2022. As always, please remember this is for educational and entertainment purposes only. Past performance does not guarantee future results, although we can always hope. Until next time, remember to be bold, be creative, and most of all, be kind. ¶¶